The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. And it's time for another edition of Civics 101, our podcast refresher course on stuff you might have learned in high school but have since forgotten. And today's question came to us from Mike, a listener in Arlington, who wanted to know about federal term limits, how long they've been around, and what it would take to change them. Virginia Prescott picks it up from here.
Here to guide us through term limits at the federal level is Roger Pilon. He's founding director of the Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute and served as a justice and State Department official in the Reagan administration. Okay, Roger, think we can help?
Yes, I think we can.
All right. Are congressional term limits spelled out in the Constitution?
No, they are not, at least were not, until the 22nd Amendment spelled them out with respect to the president. And that, of course, was a response to Franklin Roosevelt's four terms in office. But there are no term limits spelled out with respect to Congress. Not that they weren't considered. In fact, term limits go all the way back to antiquity. During the colonial period, states had term limits, and there were term limits under the Articles of Confederation. But when the Constitution was written, they were left out. And there has been a movement periodically to include them or to impose them on members of Congress. But that has come and gone for different reasons until the 1990s, the early 90s, when the term limits movement took shape. And that's where things really came to a head.
Okay, so we'll dig into that in a minute. But just to refresh, no term limits for congressional representatives or senators. They can keep running and running. And this, I didn't realize, for the vice president. So a vice president can serve more than two terms?
Yes, the vice president can.
Okay, under state laws, there are some state legislators that have term limits. But what was the rationale here? Why a term limit for the president and not for members of Congress?
History is the answer. The effort was made during the early 90s to have term limits imposed on Congress. In fact, several states came to, I believe, to 24 altogether, had passed term limits for their own members of Congress. The opposition filed suit. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And in 1995, in a case called U.S. Term Limits v. Thornton, found the imposition by states of limits on their own congressmen to be unconstitutional. That was a case in which Justice Kennedy sided with the liberals, and that put an end to term limits for the federal Congress. There are still term limits at the state level. And in fact, today, 15 states still have term limits on their own state legislators.
Why then, Roger? What was going on in the early 90s that gave this movement so much steam?
There was a continuation of the Reagan Revolution, and it continued through the Bush years, George H.W. Bush, to try to roll back the Leviathan that had afflicted us, if I may put it that way, ever since the New Deal Constitutional Revolution. And term limits were thought to be part of that agenda. The idea was to return to the principle of citizen legislators rather than the kind of legislators that we have had in the 20th century. Indeed, it was said that there is greater turnover in the Soviet Politburo than there was in the U.S. Congress. The turnover was extraordinarily rare. The number of seats that were up that were open became increasingly small.
Okay, so the imposition of term limits would put a little bit of a damper on that idea of the career politician. Well, let's look at some of the benefits and drawbacks that are made pro and con term limits.
Let me start with the pro first. The idea was, as I said, to have citizen legislators. One of the principal concerns was that these are people who, knowing that they're going to go back and live, have to live, under the laws they themselves passed, will be more solicitous of private citizens than would people who are career politicians and often are immune from the very laws that they pass. That was one of the major arguments for term limits. Another was to avoid the possibility of corruption, which tends to accompany longevity in the legislature. It was said that you need expertise to be a legislator, and you can get that only by serving long in the government. In fact, we're seeing something of that right now with respect to the president. We have a President Trump who has had no political experience whatever, and he's now in the highest office of the land and is making the kind of rookie mistakes you would expect. Well, that same issue or concern would apply to new legislators. They have to learn the ropes as they come to office.
There have been some claims that term limits do, though, however, create more competitive elections.
Oh, absolutely, because it opens up more offices. Now, here's an interesting sidebar I'll give you. The opponents included the League of Women Voters, and yet there were other women's organizations that pointed out that if you're going to get more women in Congress, you're going to have more open seats because incumbents win 16-1. And so incumbency was the greatest impediment to having more women in the legislature. And so it was sort of anomalous that you had the League of Women Voters staunchly opposed, which suggests that their bread was buttered by the incumbents.
Roger, of course, we have representatives of Congress and senators serving for decades in many cases. What do they tend to do when they get off stage if they do bow out and not choose to run again?
Well, oftentimes we've seen that at the state level, they will serve in the lower house, and then they will, after their term is up, they will run for the upper house. That's not uncommon. Or they'll run for some other, like attorney general or governor. Politicians tend to be career politicians, or they like to be. Especially now, here's a little history that is important to note. Back in the 19th century, we didn't have a great push for this because it was understood that you go to Congress and you serve just a brief time and you go back out. Most members of the House in the 19th century served only one or at most two terms. The idea of term limits includes the idea that you want to be close to the people you represent, and the longer you're there, the longer you're in the Washington cocoon, so to speak, the more remote you are from your constituents and the more out of tune you are from what their real interests are.
So a number of members of Congress or former members of Congress, I'm thinking of Eric Cantor, Tom DeLay, for example, who then became lobbyists. So no longer career politicians, but in the Washington machine. Is there a concern for that?
There is indeed. And this takes us to one of the points that I've not made, which is probably more important than any other. With the growth of government over the 20th century and now into the 21st, it is the proponents of term limits have said one of the reasons they want term limits is to roll back this Leviathan state. The opponents of term limits have the argument for against term limits because you need experts in Congress in order to manage all this complex government. There is an interesting issue here.
Well, Roger, that's the second time you've used the Leviathan that has afflicted us. So we're pretty clear on where you are coming from.
Oh, yes. I'm not hiding behind my finger.
But how about the push for term limits? Is this a bipartisan effort, or how does politics play in this?
It has not been a bipartisan effort. It has been basically Republicans who have been promoting term limits, except when they get in power. I'll say something about that in a moment. And by and large, the Democrats have been opposed to term limits. The Republicans were, they included that. You remember the Gingrich Revolution of 1994, the contract with America, included a provision among the 10 provisions for term limits for Congress. But once the Republicans took over the House for the first time in 40 years, a number of them thought better of the proposal. And that's the dirty little secret as to why there is so little turnover in Congress. It's because not voters who select their representatives, but representatives who select their voters through gerrymandering. Now, once you have that, then you have people saying, how can we get some of these people out of office? That's when they turn to term limits.
Let me ask you, however, we have seen a great deal of careerism in politics. Wondering if congressional term limits would make a big difference, or would it be politics as usual?
Well, there is a tough question to answer, because you have to look at the evidence. Those of us who have argued that term limits will help to reduce the size and scope of government look to states like California, which has had term limits, I believe, since 1993. I can't say that it has led to less government in California, quite the opposite. And so it isn't clear whether that rationale for term limits is necessarily the best one. But I haven't done an empirical study of every state. It may be that in some states that's exactly what has happened, that that has led to less government. But California, the big example, is certainly no indication of that.
Roger Pilon, thank you very much for bringing us through term limits.
Well, you're quite welcome, and I'm joyed to be with you.
If you've got a question for the Civics 101 podcast, give us a call and leave a voicemail. The number is, and I'll give you a second to grab a pen, 202-798-6865.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Ginny Moon is a teenage girl with autism, living with one in a series of foster care families. She doesn't always tell the truth, and she will not answer more than one question at a time. And she definitely won't let go of any of the 9 grapes she eats each morning. But she will give you a glimpse into an extraordinary mind. Ginny Moon is the narrator and title of the debut novel by Barrington, New Hampshire author Benjamin Ludwig, who spoke with Virginia Prescott about the book.
Benjamin Ludwig, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you, Virginia. Great to be here.
It's really nice to have you. I mean, this is a little close to home for you in some ways. You and your wife are foster parents of a teenage girl. Is she at all like Ginny?
She loves Michael Jackson, but other than that, no, not at all. Our daughter is a wonderful young lady. She's 20 years old now, and definitely intense at times, but not like Ginny.
Well, she has a very, Ginny anyway, has this very exacting and literal way of understanding the world, its rules, its expressions. How did you come up with this wholly original logic and way of thinking?
I wish I could say it was very well planned and calculated and I labored over it. But the truth is, the voice came to me fully intact, fully operational. And once it hit me, I really had to write it down and just try to keep up with it. The book really, at least the first draft, wrote itself.
What inspired that?
Well, we, at the time, were very much immersed in the world of Special Olympics. And as a public school teacher, I'd had lots and lots of kids with autism and so many intellectual disabilities in my classes. But that one year when I wrote the book, I was attending Special Olympics basketball practices with our daughter every Wednesday night, and hearing all of the voices of the athletes, talking with the parents of all these special needs kids, I think it really sunk in. It became my world, and then the voice just came out of that.
Hmm. And as a middle school teacher, I'm sure you've had a lot of experience with kids with autism.
Definitely. I think we all have at this point.
Right. And how about with trauma? Because Ginny does come from a traumatic, violent background. Do you get trained as a teacher in detecting that and in dealing with it?
Oh, most certainly. I can't think of a public school teacher who hasn't had homeless kids, foster children in their classrooms. Public school is a cross-section of society, so we get a little bit of everybody.
Yeah. Well, part of the thing about her is the language. You know, she's very precise about her language. She repeats things. She gets stuck on things. You know, there's a character named Crystal. She says, Crystal with a C. You know, it's distinguished from Crystal with a K. She's confused by idiomatic expressions. So when that voice came to you, where did the language, the actual language, play into that creation?
Well, having taught English for a very long time and having written for a very long time, I am a bit of a language nerd. So generally, when I would sit down to write, Ginny would just spill. She would just spill onto the page, sentence after sentence. And then I would go back and look and just see if there were any clever connections that weren't made but maybe could be. And some of those little pieces that got tied together is what created a lot of the humor that Ginny herself might not have been capable of.
Mm. There is a lot of humor in this, actually. You know, sort of that her logic is so kind of funny to follow in some ways because it makes so much sense to her.
She does have a way of telling the truth without trying.
And seeing people, you know, seeing beyond their, I guess, masks.
Kids in general, I think, with or without special needs, have a way of just telling it like it is, as we say, and sometimes we're not ready to hear that. My 3-year-old son made a comment about the size of somebody's feet recently, and it was absolutely true and absolutely insulting.
I'm thinking about some of the humor here. You know, she calls the character from The Sound of Music Frogline Maria.
That's right, Frogline.
And her observations in this difference in the way that people, what they say and how they behave. Now, I know that in the past, we have, every time we do any kind of segment on neural diversity, we get a lot of comments, a lot of input from our listeners. Some of them feeling very strongly about whether we get it or not. And I'm wondering, you know, especially for parents of kids on the autism spectrum, if you were at all worried about getting this right.
I'm not. First, I'm not an expert. That's very important for me to make sure people know. I'm not an expert, but I do listen to experts. And I once had an autism expert say to me, Ben, if you know one kid with autism, then you know one kid with autism. So knowing that, I'm not worried about getting autism wrong because what's autism? I won't try to define exactly what it is or how autistic people speak because they're individuals and they're tremendously unique, just as diverse as anybody else, really.
Mm. There is a triggering event in this book. The event is that the foster parents of Ginny Moon, Brian, and more, they have a new baby on the way,
mm-hmm.
and they want to be sure that Ginny will be able to handle it. She calls her parents, Brian and more, her forever mom and forever dad, but it feels much more tentative in some ways in the book. You know, she's living with her bags packed under the bed, practically. So what have you learned about that whole process of the foster care system, how it works, how children transition from one set of parents to the next?
Wow, it's tremendously complicated. But first, those terms, forever mom, forever family, forever dad, even forever dog, that's a real thing. Like, that's what kids—
They use that.
They absolutely do. And it makes perfect sense to me. I mean, are you my foster mom or are you my forever mom? Everyone wants a forever mom, right? So that's absolutely real. But we were very well, I'd like to think, very well trained by Department of Children, Youth, and Families in New Hampshire and a whole bunch of social workers. We took so many courses and so many workshops and seminars all about transition. We learned how to, not that we ever did this, but how to transition a child like directly from like a police car into your house. We were not called to that, thank goodness. But you know, you have to learn it. You have to know that these kids, some of them have been through that at some point. But transition is really what it's all about, because these kids don't know anything other than transition, really.
Benjamin Ludwig is with us. His debut novel, Ginny Moon, is written from the perspective of a teenage girl with autism. Well, she does have this obsession that she's hanging on to, and in pursuit of that, it makes perfect sense for her to contact her birth mother, dreaming up this idea of being kidnapped and brought up, brought away to Canada with her and her, you know, family, her birth family. There's a lot of, there's certainly a lot of differences in the way that Brian and Maura and her mother, her birth mother, Gloria, think of being parents. And I think in a lot of ways this points to a socioeconomic dynamic, I mean, which is not exclusively the difference in foster parents and birth parents. But how does that play out in the way that they perceive Ginny, in the way that they trust her or don't trust her?
Oh, yeah. Brian and Maura in the book, they're very socially conscious people. Maura is a doctor and Brian is high school guidance counselor. They definitely have some issues with class. They perceive themselves, I think it's safe to say, as being saviors in a way. They certainly look down on Ginny's birth mother, maybe not for inappropriate reasons, all things considered. But they also look down their noses at her birth dad, Rick, who drives a truck. And that's they never say it, but you can tell they have some judgments.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Rick is this character that actually brings a kind of breath of fresh perspective. The man who has not raised Ginny some insight into how she should be treated.
Yeah, Rick's my favorite character. I love Rick.
I wondered where he came from, where he came from in this kind of creation of this whole narrative arc.
I just wanted some regular guy who was in a difficult position with his daughter to be able to have very, very good intentions and almost be able to make good on those good intentions and then maybe say the wrong thing. It just seemed like the right thing to have in a story.
You know, Benjamin, this book, it's the first publication from a new imprint. It's called Park Row. What's the parent company? I'm sorry, I'm forgetting.
HarperCollins.
Yeah, we've heard of them.
Yeah.
so this is a big deal. I wonder what this experience is like for you. This is your debut novel, and it's getting a lot of drum roll behind it.
It's absolutely unreal. I mean, finishing a book, I've finished a lot of books. I mean, I have a whole bunch of books, you know, dating back before there was a hard drive to put them on. Finishing a book is a big deal. Getting an agent is a really big deal. Having the agent say, okay, we're ready to actually send this out is, you know, that's it, I'm done. But then there was an offer, and I couldn't believe it. It was phenomenally life-changing just to know that, you know, at least two people, the agent and the editor, liked something I had written. So I'm just very grateful and overwhelmed.
Any advice for somebody who is plugging away at trying to get a novel out there?
Yeah, keep spinning the wheel. You'll never know. You will never know which of your efforts will produce some level of success. I had sent out the same query letters, we call them in the industry, query letter describing Ginny Moon, different title at the time. But I had sent out so many, easily, 50, maybe 100, I don't know, it was a few years ago, hard to remember. But one person said, I'd like to read the rest of this book. And so, yeah, just keep trying, you know.
Benjamin Ludwig, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you. Very much appreciate it.
Benjamin Ludwig is author of the new novel, Ginny Moon. He's going to be reading and talking about the book at Water Street Books in Exeter, New Hampshire on Monday, May the 1st. There's more information at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Benjamin Ludwig is author of the new novel, Ginny Moon. He'll be reading and talking about the new book at Water Street Books in Exeter, New Hampshire, on Monday, May 1st. There's more information at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And coming up after a break, it's our regular tech segment, A Series of Tubes. Stick around.
I want to play you another one.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott.
The internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's a series of tubes.
And that 8-bit theme is the telltale sign that it's time for A Series of Tubes, our regular run-through of tech stories with Rob Fleischman, tech pundit and principal architect at Akamai Technologies. A few weeks ago, Rob sent us an email saying he was interested in doing a primer on password managers, which was good timing because not too long ago, both Virginia Prescott and I were complaining about getting locked out of important online accounts.
Absolutely. So password managers, this goes to our conversation about the importance of passwords. And I will just give my blanket statement that I always say, and that is, please, everyone out there, remember, your most important password is not the one for your bank account or your brokerage account or any of that. It's actually your email password. So please, if you take anything away from this show today, that your email password should be different than all of your other passwords, and it should be hard to guess and complicated.
Okay, did you just hear that internal clunk?
Please don't use the same password for Twitter as you do for email, as you do for Facebook, as you do for your, you know, recipe website that you log into.
Why not?
Because as we know, the security of all those places are not the same. So if your recipe blog website gets hacked and the password's stolen, the bad guys could use those passwords to log into more important things.
Okay, so then you have a million passwords where every site you log into, maybe shop on, you know, every app you use. How do you remember all
exactly
these?
And that's really the problem. And that's where password managers come in, right? So what ends up happening is people end up either using really trivial passwords for all these sites or the same password for all these sites. So what password managers do is they are applications or plugins for your web browser, for your phone, for your desktop, for your tablet that manage passwords. It's kind of like putting all your eggs in one basket. You think up a really good password, a really hard password, and then you use that to encrypt, to store, like in a strong box, all the passwords for all your other websites. And by doing that, it makes it so you can have different passwords for every website, because guess what? You don't need to remember them. You just need to remember the one password that opens up your strong box, your password manager.
Okay, but isn't the phrase don't put all of your eggs in one basket? I mean, wouldn't these things, if they're password managers, unlock the key to everything so people with bad motives might be trying to get into those especially?
You're absolutely right. But there's a slight difference here, and that is the people who write password managers, and there are a number of great ones to choose from. There are big names like 1Password and LastPass and Sticky Password. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. They're available for every platform you could name, and they have different price points and different features. But all of those guys all are cognizant of security, right? These are serious security people with high-end cryptography. Some of them have two-factor authentication, all kinds of great stuff. So if you're going to store your password somewhere, it's much better in a password manager than in a sticky note stuck to your monitor or in a piece of paper slid under your keyboard or in your head where you forget. So I know what you're saying about all eggs in one basket, but a lot of people do that anyway, and I'm just suggesting have a really strong, secure basket.
Passwords, of course, are all about privacy, which is something we talked about a couple of months ago. Now, this was when congressional Republicans were trying to repeal some of the Obama-era internet privacy laws that required ISPs, internet service providers, so this is the Comcast, you know, the AT&Ts, to get consumer permission to sell their data. Now, those laws have been repealed. So what does this actually mean for consumers?
Well, you're exactly right. So during the Obama administration, they moved forward with a bill to require ISPs to ask you to explicitly say, Virginia, do we have your permission? Please opt in. Opt in, please, for us to use your data and sell it to advertisers. So that actually never went into effect. I mean, it was supposed to go into effect sometime in the future. And the new administration said, you know, we're just going to get rid of that, and that's never going to go into effect. So in some sense, what the new administration said is, we're going to keep things as they are.
So we're always opted in unless we opt out?
That's exactly right. So it turns out in the real world, as we know, when we go to our Googles, our Facebooks, our Amazon, basically any website in the world, our mail, any consumer place, any news place, they're collecting data about us, right? You see this. Everyone has seen the, I went shopping for something, I didn't buy it, and then all of a sudden ads for that appear everywhere, right? Everywhere I go, there are ads. That's because everybody is selling your data. Everybody really, except your ISPs, they've been really hesitant to do that because of these laws that have been pending. So what's going to happen now is these ISPs, you know, you're absolutely your internet providers, your Sprints, your Comcast, your
cable. But not your Facebooks and Twitters.
Oh, they're already doing it, right? They are unaffected by this, right? They are already collecting absolutely as much data as they can on you, trading it, selling it, using it to optimize ads. So this law was really about, is your ISP, is the provider of internet service that you pay every month, right? That's a little different, right? You're paying these people. Are they allowed to play in the same game, in the same area as Google and Facebook and all the others? So what has come to pass is the answer is yes, they can. However, even with the new administration, unlike Google and Facebook and others, they are by law required to give you now an opt-out. So you will be able to log into your ISP, the account they give you, and you'll be able to opt out of this data collection.
I have never seen that option.
That is quite true. And they are, as you might imagine, not incentivized to make that option quite obvious to you. And you may have to hunt around for it in the next 6 months.
Well, I know that a lot of people are, you know, of course, the Electronic Frontier Foundation is freaked out about this. A lot of privacy people are. But I'm trying to figure out, like, who's for it? What could possibly be the upside of we're selling your information to advertisers?
Well, the upside of the internet providers, of course. You know, this is a gigantic revenue stream, and they feel like they should have an equal playing field. Why is it that Google can collect an infinite amount of data on you and sell it to anybody they want, right? Now, the opposing side says, well, the reason why Google can do that is because they're giving you services. You know, you're using your search engine, and you're not paying for that. You're on Facebook, you're not paying for that. Well, how do you pay? Well, you pay by letting them use your data, right? So, you know, an internet provider, when you're paying your monthly bill, well, you're paying for that, you know? So should they be allowed to additionally use your data? You know, that's where the argument is based.
Okay, so how freaked out should we be about this on a scale from 1 to 10?
I think it should be a 2 or a 3.
Really?
And the reason why I say it's that low is because, honestly, what's out there now is much more pervasive and much more skilled, right? The Comcasts and the Verizons of the world, they're in junior high right now compared to the Googles and Facebooks who are graduate PhD level at data collection and selling. So, you know, maybe someday those guys will get amazing and they'll be really intrusive. But today I'm not too worried. It's just adding another set of players to the same game we're all in.
Okay, well, talking about players, let's move to Apple News. It's the 10th anniversary of the iPhone. Holy moly.
Oh, my goodness.
What a revolution.
The hype is incredible, right? 10th anniversary. Can you imagine that? It's only been 10 years. It seems like we've had these devices forever.
Well, they've certainly been glued to us forever. But there are rumors about the iPhone 8. What are you hearing?
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Crazy rumor. So although I do have friends at Apple, their security is amazing. These people won't tell me anything. But I have seen some rumors, and rumors really are currently, I guess the latest and greatest is there might be 3 models coming sometime in the fall, in quotes. I don't know what the fall means. Is that August? Is it November? I don't know. But my understanding is there'll be an upgrade to the 2 big models they have, right? We have the iPhone 7, so I imagine there'll be some 7 super version, 7S, whatever it is. And I heard there's going to be an even higher end version, one with things like curved glass and made out of stainless steel, and the entire display goes to the very edges, and I've heard rumors of wireless charging and all kinds of crazy stuff, and, you know, making it waterproof where you can use it underwater. There's been rumors of all different shapes and sizes. There's been camera upgrades and augmented reality and virtual reality and, you know, OLED displays, and I mean, you name it, there's been lots of rumors. And there's also been rumors on the supply side, like, oh my goodness, they can't get enough of this stuff and it's going to be delayed because of that. So the Apple rumor mill is in full effect.
Okay, so none of these are verifiable, but how about, all right, other rumors. Apple Car, what's happening?
Yeah, so Apple Car is really interesting. So a few years ago, Apple had a, you know, closely guarded project called the Titan, and this was the Apple Car, self-driving Apple Car. You know, you've heard of the Google Car. And
it's going to just look better.
Oh, it'll look great and everything, right? And then, of course, you know, in late 2016, again, a rumor, of course, because maybe this Titan project never existed, but the rumor is that the Titan project was canned, was ended. And now the rumors really are that Apple is still in the self-driving car business, and they're interested in it from a software side. And I think these rumors have a much greater chance of being true. And the reason why is, think about what's happened, right? There was a rumor about an Apple TV, building a whole TV. We know that went away, right? And the Apple TV is really software that you add. And look at Apple's history with the iPod, with tablets, with the phone, with the computer. They're not really the folks to come out with the first version. They're the ones to come out with the revolutionary version. So if you look at Apple's playbook and you think about self-driving cars, what's going to happen? People are going to come out with self-driving cars, just like they did for all those other things with tablets and phones and you name it. And then Apple will come along thoughtfully and think about what they did, the good, the bad, the indifferent, and they will revolutionize it. So I believe that if there is going to be an Apple car, in quotes, that it'll really be a set of software that Apple will make available either to us directly or to car manufacturers that really up the game on self-driving computer-enhanced automobiles.
So the iPhone was not the first smartphone?
Oh, no, of course not. We had lots of smartphones before that. And not to go back into archaeology, but we actually did an episode on early technology where we talked about the Zune and iPlayer. Yeah, we could dig that out of the word of mouth archives.
You know, it's probably on my password manager that I just don't remember.
That's okay, Virginia. We've been doing this for 6 years now, so it's hard to remember everything.
All right, Rob Fleischman, always keeping us up to date. He's our tech pundit and principal architect at Akamai Technologies. Rob, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Broke for Free, Poddington Bear, and Uncanny Valleys. There's loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott, and this has been Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.